Good evening and welcome to tonight's Natural and Creative Capital Program, hosted by the Montalvo Arts Center and Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Alison Van Diggelen and I'm host of Fresh Dialogues, and it's my great pleasure to be your moderator this evening. We're proud to present tonight's program as a collaborative effort, and we invite you to visit our websites, MontalvoArtsCenter.org and CommonwealthClub.org, where you will find details about our other events and other speakers. We'd also like to thank the Youth Science Institute. One event coming up is on Wednesday, May 18th, when Anna Lapp, founding principal of the Small Planet Institute and author of Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It, will outline her 7 principles for a climate-friendly diet. During our program, we'll have time for questions, and you should all have a question card, or you can get one from our staff or volunteers, and we'll be taking questions throughout the program. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce Mark Kurlansky, author of World Without Fish. And a few background pieces of information about Mark. After graduating from Butler University, Mark spent several years as a foreign correspondent, working in Western Europe and writing for the Miami Herald, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the Paris-based International Tribune. He's published over 20 fiction, nonfiction, and children's books, which have been translated into 25 languages. For his outstanding writing, including his best-selling books, Cod and Salt, Mark is the recipient of numerous awards from the New York Public Library, Food Writer of the Year from Bon Appetit magazine, and the James Beard Award for Food Writing. Joining Mark today is his 10-year-old daughter and fishing companion, Talia. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mark and Talia Kurlansky.
Thank you. I had an idea for this book because I have talked a lot about these issues over the years because I've written several other books, Cod, The Big Oyster, Last Fish Tale, which involve these issues, and I've gone around and talked to people and I've gone and talked to schools. And I find that people are very confused about this whole issue, which they should be because it's very complicated. And I had this idea of writing a family book in the same sense as a family movie, a book that would be for kids, but also for their parents, so that a family could all read the book and hopefully discuss it.
At the end of each chapter, there is a section of a comic book.
You're supposed to call it a graphic novel.
A graphic novel. That every chapter is a section of this story that gets continued. And it's the story of Professor Cram, a biologist, a marine biologist, and his daughter, a lot. And it starts from when she's about 6 to when she's about 36. And she has a daughter, and she becomes a marine biologist. And it's just about her life. They have some friends who are fishermen. And it's just how her father keeps on trying to tell people, we need to change your ways or the fish are going to start disappearing and it's going to really hurt the environment. And no one listens to him. And then through the years, their fishermen friends start catching less and they're noticing differences. And it's kind of a sad story towards the end. It's kind of sad, but
Yeah, it's a complete bummer, but it's fiction, you know. It's the worst case scenario, and the rest of the book is about how it doesn't have to be like that. I just wanted to lay out what was going on, what would happen if it didn't get fixed, which would be really bad, what people were trying to do to fix it, what was working, what wasn't, and what you could do. And I found that if I could explain this clearly to a 9 or 10 year old, that I would also, it would also be clear, to adults. I was explaining this on, TV in San Francisco, Henry Tannenbaum, and he said, yes, that's what we do in television. what was your role? So Talia had a role in this.
When my dad was finished writing a chapter, he would give it to me, and I'd look through it, and I'd read it, and I'd tell him, well, one, I'd make sure he didn't get too boring.
That's a great service, isn't it, to have somebody who tells you when you're getting boring?
But then if I didn't understand something, and it was confusing to me what he was trying to explain, I'd tell him and he'd explain it more in the book. Or if there was something that I felt he wasn't explaining enough and I needed more information on it, I'd tell him and he'd add facts and more things about it. So in a way, I was sort of a mini editor.
So now you're going to grill us ruthlessly.
I have a bunch of questions here, and I do invite the audience, if something comes up in our conversation that you'd like to hear more about, or if there's something I missed, I would love to get your contributions. So I'd like to start by backing up. You know, we've got an idea of the concept of the book, but I would like to know, what was the light bulb moment for you, Mark? When, describe the day or the moment you thought, I have to write this book, and I have to write it for families or for kids.
Well, there were several light bulbs involved there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. Originally, my original idea was a card game. Mm. I had this idea for a card game, and there would be fishing gear cards, and there would be fish cards. And the object of the game was to get as many fish cards as possible. But if you took all the fish cards, you'd lose. And my agent took this idea to Workman, the publisher, because they do a lot of wacky things like that. And then they wanted it to be a book. So then I started thinking about the book idea. And I just started thinking about all the talks that I've given on this subject. And, what really struck me, I'm very struck by her generation and how interested and concerned and upset they are by what's going on in the environment. I think that we may be raising a whole generation of militant environmentalists, and I'm looking forward to that. But they don't have much information. And I wanted to inform them. And I think that there's a tendency to talk down to kids and to underestimate them. But I think kids understand a lot more than most grown-ups realize. It's kind of irritating to kids when they're always underestimated. And then it occurred to me that in doing this process of, you know, explaining the whole thing and making it clear, that's exactly what adults need too. I can't tell you the exact moment when that, but early in the process that became, part of the goal.
Right. And it is a complex problem. We actually had the pleasure of having dinner here at Villa Montalvo, and we talked a little about the problem. Can you, for the audience tonight, can you simplify and give us what the key problems are that are affecting fish in our oceans today?
Yeah. If you look at, well, there's two things biologically you have to understand. It all comes from Darwin. Actually, every chapter in the book begins with a quote from Darwin, because Darwin explained the natural order better than anyone else has. And any environmental issue that you're concerned about, read The Origin of the Species. I mean, he talked about climate change and biodiversity and all these things that there weren't even words for in the 1860s when he wrote it. And one thing he said was that it takes a very large number of individuals for a species to be successful. And that's a very important concept, that if the number of individuals declines below a certain point, that species can no longer survive. What that point is unknown and depends on a lot of other circumstances. But it is clear that you can't let the number of individuals become too small, or the species will be gone. The other thing is that any species needs lots of other different kinds of species in order to survive. Because what we call the food chain is really more like a web than a chain. And I've been thinking about aquariums a lot of late, because we've been giving talks in aquariums. And, you know, aquariums try to show people marine life, but they show it in a completely unnatural setting, because they feed all the fish, and so they don't eat each other. And in real life, everybody's eating everybody. But that wouldn't work in an aquarium. First of all, parents wouldn't want to take their kids to see it, although, you know, I think the kids would like it. But if you didn't feed them and they started eating each other, soon you would have an empty aquarium. Why is that tank different from the ocean? It's different because there aren't enough of individuals of each species that's in the tank, and there's not enough different kinds of species in the tank. So if the wild, if the ocean became like that aquarium, fish would be gone. And the first thing that set this off was the fact that fishermen, for all of human history, have seen their job as trying to catch as many fish as they can. Any bit of knowledge they get, any kind of technology they get, they use to catch more fish. And then they reached a point where all the fish they could catch was all the fish in the ocean. So then they had to rethink it. And they had to think about, instead of about how many more fish can I catch, it's how many fish would it be okay to catch, and how can I earn a living on that amount of fish.
And can you talk, Mark, a little about the technology innovations that produced that effect?
Well, what really did it in was the engine-powered boat. It was really fun when it was everybody was under sail, which in the U.S. they were under sail for well into the 20th century. Once they started dragging nets, they needed engines. Engines had been invented long before they used them on fishing boats. And once they started dragging nets, they needed engines, because when you're under sail power, your speed is inconsistent and the net won't stay billowed behind you as it slows down and speeds up. Once they started dragging nets on engine-powered vessels, the trouble began. This started in the North Sea in the 1880s. And by the 1890s, there was a noticeable decline in fish stocks in the southern banks of the North Sea. And then they started fishing other places. And everywhere they went, there was a decline in fish stocks. And when it came over to the U.S., U.S. fish stocks started declining. There's a number of other types of gear that there are issues with, but this was the principal thing that kicked it off.
Mm-hmm. And you're ultimately talking about fish extinction, but you draw a distinction between commercial extinction and biological extinction. Can you explain the difference there?
Yeah, although, you know, it's not the good news I used to think it was. Mm-hmm. Commercial extinction is when the population of a species gets so low that it's not profitable to fish that species anymore. And so fishermen just don't bother with it. They don't target it anymore. So you would think that that would be great because it would mean that before it became biologically extinct, everybody laid off and it would come back. But the problem is that usually by the time it gets to commercial extinction, the population is too low to rebuild. So at commercial extinction, biological extinction often isn't that far behind.
And can you cite some examples of fish that are commercially extinct?
Well, the Atlantic cod in the Grand Banks of Canada is commercially extinct, which was the most famous, most productive fishing population in the history of the Atlantic.
Right. So let's talk about solutions. We want to try and be a little upbeat here because, as you mentioned, the book, you know, it's a bit of a bummer story, but it also has some great solutions in it. So let's focus on that right now. Solutions to overfishing. It's not a complete panacea. Can you describe some of the solutions that you outline in the book?
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand that, you know, in the sweep of human history, we haven't been regulating fisheries for that long. So there's a lot of trial and error going on, but we don't have that much time left to figure it out. When I go to schools and I ask kids, I present the problem and say, okay, what would you do to regulate the fishery? And they always, always say, you know, hand goes up and it's tell the fishermen to catch less fish each time they go out. And that's exactly what everybody thought was the best solution. So a friend of mine in Gloucester, Massachusetts, where we spend part of the year, oldest fishing port in America, let's get the commercial in, when they first put a quota on codfish, which was the traditional target species there, they told him that on each trip he could only catch 500 pounds of cod. So he went out and he caught 1,000 pounds. And, you know, he was an honest fisherman and he radioed into New England Fishery Management like you're supposed to and told them when he was coming in and what his catch was. And they were waiting for him on the dock. And he says, you know, here it is, 1,000 pounds of cod. So I can't go out tomorrow because this is two trips. And they said, no, doesn't work like that. This is one trip and you have to take 500 pounds and throw it out. And that's how it works. And so every year we are taking millions and millions of pounds of fish and throwing them away in the name of good fishery management. Most fish that get to a fisherman's deck are dead or at least damaged enough so that they're not going to make it if you throw them back into the sea. So we've learned that this is a very limited tool. There's a lot of other things, like limiting the number of days that a fisherman can go to sea, which is extremely hard on fishermen because they have this expensive vessel to maintain and, you know, they can't work half the year, sometimes more than half the year. Another solution is to close off areas, which they're doing a lot now in California and having some success with. You close off an area and say there's no fishing here. You fish in another area. And so you're putting a lot of pressure on the areas where you can fish, but hopefully the areas where you didn't fish will get rebuilt before the areas where you are fishing get into trouble. Sometimes that works, and sometimes they don't rebuild, and we don't know why. There's tons of stuff going on in the ocean that we don't know about. We don't know the effect of climate change. We know that fish take their spawning cues from temperature and salinity and that the temperature is changing and the water is getting less salty because the polar ice caps are melting. We don't know exactly how that's affecting fish. We don't know what the impact of all of the oil products that are ending up in the sea are, or all of the plastic which fish then feed on. Huge amount of plastic in the ocean and chromium and mercury and PCBs. And we don't know what the impact on fish of these things are. We don't know what the impact of that irradiated water that's been dumped in the Pacific is. I mean, you're told that it won't do any harm. And that could be true. But the truth is that it's never been done before. It's never been studied. Nobody has any idea what the impact is. So, you know, there's lots of things going on that are beyond our control.
Mm. And Mark, you have worked as a commercial fisherman, and I found your book. It didn't paint fishermen as villains at all. Can you share a little of your experience as a commercial fisherman and how that influenced your writing of the book?
Well, I was a commercial fisherman when I was 17, 18 years old, and at a time in New England, which is where I'm from, at a time when there were many more fishing ports than there are now, and a kid could just wander from port to port and say, "Who needs a hand?" And you know, eventually you would find somebody. And you know, I was a fairly big, strong kid and didn't have any skill or particular knowledge at all, but you know, somebody has to haul 250 lines of rope and 250 feet of rope, and you know, so I did things like that, and I loved it. I loved being at sea. I loved working with fishermen. Fishermen are non-salaried workers with a tremendous sense of freedom and independence. Extremely resourceful. You know, the engine breaks down and they know how to fix it. Anything that comes up, they know incredible things with knots. Just they know lots of things, and they're so fearless that I didn't have the sense to be scared. It's incredibly dangerous. I never felt afraid because, you know, if nobody around you acts scared, you know, it doesn't occur to you. You know, if I just saw one person with a worried face, it might have done it. But they, you know, just accept this way of life, and they love it. And you'd come into port and you'd just feel sorry for all those people who are stuck working on land all day.
And it is a dangerous job. I mean, there's a high mortality rate.
There is, and it's year after year, the Labor Department rates it the most dangerous job in America, and in Europe the same thing.
Did you experience any of that when you were working?
Well, nothing bad ever happened to me. I worked with a lot of people who were missing fingers and joints, little pieces of themselves here and there. And you know, when you were told these things, like when the net went out on a bottom dragger, they had these planks called doors. There's steel reinforced wood planks that keep the nets wide open, and they just fly across the deck. And you know, somebody would say, you know, when the doors play out, you know, get out of the way because it'll kill you. You know, okay. You know, you got to make sure you don't step into the coil of an outgoing line because it'll drag you out to sea and drown you.
And do you get to eat the harvest? I mean, is it a jolly dinner you have when you come in as a fisherman, or are you sick of the sight and the smell of fish after you're done?
We'd eat stuff at sea, and sometimes, you know, we take something home. But most of the fishermen that I worked with in New England and in Maritime Canada also, they were kind of meat and potatoes kind of guys.
They wouldn't touch fish then.
You know, every once in a while. My fondest memory of, it's in my cod book, of a fish meal at sea was I was handlining on a cod skiff off of Newfoundland with these three guys. And this was after the moratorium on fishing, and they were signed on by the government to go to certain places and we'd just see how many fish we could catch, and then we'd tag them and throw them back. And they gave us this tool. It looks kind of like the, you know, that thing they have in stores that puts the price tag on things, but it actually had this needle that shot into the flesh of the fish and put a tag in it. You know, so we first started doing this, I got this nice big cod. And the first guy starts going, hey, it's not sticking. And he passes on to the next guy. We passed the thing around. You know, nobody could figure out. Finally, somebody got the tag so it would stay in the fish. And at that point, we realized it was dead, so we cooked it and ate it.
That's a great story. So talk about fish farms, Mark. I mean, some people have said that that is a possible solution to overfishing, but they have a lot of bad press, chemicals and disease, et cetera. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it doesn't really address the problem. It attempts to address the problem of nutrition. You know, the Food and Agriculture Organization says that the seas should double their output of protein for the, you know, this huge growth in population. And clearly that cannot be done on commercial wild fishing. So it would then have to be farmed fish. But the idea that, you know, we're going to feed all the hungry people by all the fish we farm sounds so much to me like the claim of agro industry years ago that, you know, with agro industry, they were going to end hunger. And they didn't end hunger because it turns out that the problem is never the lack of food. It's the distribution and the unfairness of the distribution of wealth and the fact that, you know, food doesn't get to poor people. There are lots of problems with fish farming, and I suppose they could be solved and fish farming could make a contribution to food supply, although, as I say, it still wouldn't answer the question of how do we work with the oceans and make all this work. But most farmed fish are fed wild fish that has been scooped up by the most abusive huge factory trawlers and then ground up and into meal and pressed into pellets, so that when you eat a farmed fish, you're probably killing more wild fish than if you just ate a wild fish. And it's also extremely polluting. There are attempts now to not feed fish wild fish and to feed them things like corn, but, you know, fish aren't really built for that kind of a diet, so then you get into chemical supplements and all that stuff ends up being bad too. Just the crowded fish pens are polluting to the ocean. The fish become mutant. You know, fish, all animals adapt to habitat, and fish evolve very quickly because they go through generations in a short number of years. So in our aquarium at home, we have a fish that has no eyes. And the reason it has no eyes is that it comes from a place, deep water caves that have no light. So after numerous generations of not using eyes, they just didn't have eyes anymore. Farm fish, don't know how to hunt for food. They can't swim distances. They don't have any of the skills required to, survive in the wild. And if they get out, which they sometimes have, and mix with the wild species, they could destroy the entire species. So there's just a lot of problems with farm fish.
So after all your research, would you advise us to avoid it at all costs?
Well, the thing about this subject that drove my editor crazy is that there are caveats to absolutely everything. And that's the problem when you look at these websites, you know, these things like the Monterey Aquarium, and they say this is a good fish to eat, avoid this fish. It's too general. They'll say avoid Atlantic codfish, but you shouldn't avoid an Atlantic codfish that was caught by hook and line. So there's exceptions. There are non-harmful farmed fish too.
Oysters.
Yeah. I mean, oysters are are different than fish because. The problem with fish is that you're changing what they do, and so you're changing the fish. But a farmed oyster does the exact same thing as a wild oyster, which is absolutely nothing. You know, so that's fine. And I think tilapia is probably fine because tilapia eats. You know, they were brought here to clean out canals and things because they eat vegetables. You know, they eat algae and green stuff, and they don't eat other fish. I was saying this to a guy who was interviewing me for a magazine, and he said, "Yeah, but you know, tilapia are just so bland; they don't have any taste." I said, "Well, they're vegetarians, you know."
So you got to add a hot sauce or something.
Right.
So, Talia, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. I know you worked closely with your dad on this book, and you told him when it got boring. Can you tell us what you think was your biggest contribution to the book? Was there a particular chapter that you helped with? Or?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I did was I think that it was good because I helped him with complications, and if it got too boring, I think it gave it a very, like, a 10-year-old point of view and a child's point of view, which that got mixed into it a little, which I think was very good.
What do you mean by a 10-year-old's point of view?
Like, when my dad came to my school and talked to my friends, it changed a lot of opinions on my friends, what they thought, which I find going on book tour with my dad, kids and adults' opinions are the same, which is we need to do something, but they have slight little differences. And I know that in humanities we were given a homework assignment where we needed to write persuasive paragraphs. And we needed to pick a subject that was bothered us and we had a strong opinion on in the world and that we wanted to write about. And I have a friend who, after my dad came, she decided to do overfishing. So I think when I say a 10-year-old's point of view, just what kids my age feel about the subject and what we think we can do. And
That's great. And so do you feel you've already changed some points of view and got people thinking about it?
Yes, I do.
That's awesome. And I understand you have a little aquarium at home. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. It's this square aquarium in our living room, and it has, I don't know, like 17 fish, shrimp, and we've enjoyed taking care of it, and we've learned about different behaviors. We've learned about fish eating each other, unfortunately. And
so you've seen that happen?
Yes, I have.
We don't see it happen. We find it.
Sometimes
somebody is missing it.
we have a shark that's about this big.
We have a little tiny shark who appears to be smiling at some time.
And what do your friends think of your book tour with Dad and the book? Are they pretty excited?
We were in New England, and I came back to school for about one day before I headed to California. And all my friends came up to me. They're like, "Where were you? What was going on? Tell us everything. How was it like? What's New England like? Da-da-da-da-da."
So does it make you want to become an author? And particularly an author that talks about environmental issues. Is this something that's a passion for you?
I'm not sure. I enjoy writing a lot. I write poetry. I write books. I write a lot. I'm not really sure. I like a lot of stuff. I like dancing. I like writing. I like acting. So.
Do you have any short pieces of poetry you can share with us tonight? On fish, particularly?
Not with me. I do have poetry.
If we had known you were going to ask.
I do have things like that. Whenever we give like a homework assignment in a humanities class, write a poem about something. You're only supposed to write one poem. I end up writing about 5, 10. My friends are like, "Why do you write so many?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I just got carried away."
Her poetry is surprisingly beat-like. So I took her to North Beach today to see if anything would happen, right?
And? Did you feel the vibe?
The vibe.
Yes.
Good. Okay, we have a question from the audience here for you, Mark. When you wrote Cod, were the problems with the fishing industry evident?
Yes. Yeah. As a matter of fact, it was kind of a moment in the fishing industry because the northern cod stock in the Canadian Grand Banks had just collapsed. And this was a shocking thing. This was the last fish stock anybody had thought would be in trouble. Famous for hundreds of years as being one of the most plentiful fish stocks in the world. So this was a moment when everybody was talking a lot more about fishery management and dealing with the problem, and fishery management was getting a lot more serious. And that actually was part of the reason why I wrote the book, because I realized that cod was a great story. I'm essentially a storyteller, and what I look for is a good story. And it was this great story that went over 500 years in all Atlantic countries. And then I realized that, like any really good story, it had a sad ending. You know, that was the kind of the clincher on the idea, putting the idea of the book together.
Great. Now we have a question from the audience here about the number of commercial fishermen or women there are in the U.S. and how that number has changed in the last 5 to 10 years. Do you have any information?
I couldn't give you total numbers, except in my home port of Gloucester, where it's down to about 400 from what used to be thousands, and Gloucester is still one of the 10 biggest fishing ports in the United States. I don't have an overall figure, but there are many fewer fishermen than there used to be. The sons of fishermen aren't going to fish. Their parents are really urging their kids not to become fishermen.
Mm-hmm. No future in it.
Right, and some do anyways. And they, you know, I know in Gloucester, it's so close to places like Harvard and MIT and all these famous universities, and they, you know, these kids go off to these places and they're so happy and so proud. You know, my son's at Harvard and my son's at MIT, and then they graduate and they come back and want to work on the boat and the father thing. No.
Yeah, you've spent a fortune. Yes.
Right.
It's been a little over a year since the BP oil spill. Can you talk about the recovery period for the region and the fishermen in the area? Is that something you've focused in on?
Somewhat, and I've looked at oil accidents in general. And the thing you have to realize about this is that cleanup is just visible cleanup. In 1969, a diesel barge broke up off of Cape Cod, off of Falmouth, and all of this black muck washed up on the beaches of Cape Cod, these famous beaches. So it got a lot of press attention, particularly because a crude oil barge broke up off of Santa Barbara and deposited muck on that beach. So these were, you know, one of the most famous beaches on the West Coast and one of the most famous beaches on the East Coast, covered with oil gunk. And they cleaned them up, and the beaches looked just the way they looked before, and people went back to the beaches, and it was over and forgotten about. But today, scientists from the Woods Hole Laboratory in Cape Cod go into the marshes and find the residue of that 1969 diesel and study its impact on the genetics and reproduction of marine life.
41 years later.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised at her math. this incident in Cape Cod and the incident in Santa Barbara are really small compared to the BP. That was a huge, huge amount of oil. There's a lot of attention being paid right now to whether the seafood is safe to eat, which it probably is. But the bigger question is it going to reproduce? And is that food chain still functioning? Is that ecosystem still functioning the way it should be? And, you know, the Gulf of Mexico is not a closed sea. So, you know, we're talking about the whole Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. So time will tell,
right,
really, is your answer. And let's talk about in particular, we have a question from the audience here, the Japanese whaling fleet. What do you think about them being forced to cut short their season? What would be the result of that?
You know, the problem with the Japanese whaling fleet and the problem with bluefin tuna and a lot of these issues with Japan is that we have failed to make this a priority of U.S. and European governments, so that this is not something that in the many or shark and China in the many bilateral and multilateral economic talks that go on between these countries, they're not talking about this stuff. This stuff gets talked about in environmental conferences. And if it were hooked into economic relations, it would have we'd see much more results, which is why I tell everybody, you know, that to write your elected representatives and tell them you're concerned about this stuff, because basically Congress thinks that this is something that people in Massachusetts, Washington State, and Alaska worry about. Because those are states where it's a large part of the economy. There's a lot of fishing in California, but it's a minor part of the California economy. And, you know, we need people from Ohio writing in and saying that, you know, that we care about this. Cutting short the fishing, I mean, anything that you can do to diminish the hunt would be helpful.
Right. And let's talk about global warming. We have a question from the audience. With the ice caps melting, what will be the effect on plankton concentrations? What will be the impact on the rest of the food chain?
Well, you know, like so many of these questions, the honest answer is who knows? This stuff has not been studied nearly enough to say for certain. As far as plankton goes, the effect of declining fish populations is that there's more and more plankton. There's more and more red tides, toxic blooms, because there's less things eating it. You know, in the really bad scenario, in our little comic strip, you know, it gets down to I've asked a number of marine biologists what would happen if you had 20, 30 major fish species collapsing at around the same time, and they all say the same thing, that the only disagreement is some say the ocean will turn orange and slimy, and some say it'll turn pink and slimy. One leading biologist said I could take my pick. So that's what I told Frank Stockton, the illustrator. He went with orange.
It's a beautiful book, Mark, I have to say.
Yeah, thank you.
It really is a beautiful book. And the illustrations are quite magnificent. I would call it a cartoon, but that's
right.
Just me coming from Britain.
So it's going in that direction. And, you know, it could... you could send the whole evolution backwards. You could send the whole ecosystem into this tailspin where there was nothing left but plankton and zooplankton. Zooplankton, jellyfish is the most prominent zooplankton. Jellyfish would do fine, and we've already seen a lot of increase in jellyfish population. I call jellyfish the cockroach of the sea because, you know, they're this animal that we don't really like very much, but, you know, they're going to make it. They're just really built for survival. They can eat their predators. They can become bigger. They can become smaller. They can change their diets. They're you know, they're really going to last. So, you know, any of you who are familiar with my books know that I like to give recipes.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed that.
The only recipe I have in this book is for jellyfish salad.
You tried it, Mark?
Well, I love jellyfish salad. I eat, every time I come to San Francisco, I go to Chinatown and eat jellyfish salad. But today, we were in Chinatown, and I wanted Talia to have some jellyfish salad. And we went into this Chinese restaurant that had it on the menu, and we sat there. And Talia looked really unhappy. I would say kind of depressed. So I said, let's go to North Beach and have some Italian food. She said, okay. And we left. But so save that recipe because, you know, it may be the only seafood dish you have.
So, Talia, you haven't tried it yet?
No.
Okay. No. But according to the scenario of your dad's book, that's going to be all that's left, right?
Well, he's described it to me, and it doesn't sound that bad.
It's not that bad. It's a traditional...
It sounds like squid.
Yeah, it's a traditional Chinese dish.
Great. So here's a question from the audience for you, Talia. What have you learned while writing and helping your dad edit this book? What are some of the key things you've learned?
Well, before the book was being written, my dad just talked to me about this. So I already knew a lot. And having talks and going through talks and interviews, we've noticed I'm starting to steal my dad's lines.
Good for you. You're going to make your dad redundant.
No, right? Yes, soon I will stay home and she'll do the book talk.
Well, she's a beautiful spokesman for you.
And a couple weeks ago, my dad was doing a phone interview, and we were getting ready to pack for California. And I was in my room packing, and I could hear from the living room my dad doing the interview. And my mom came in, and she was like, you must know a lot what he's about to say. And I'm like, you have no idea. So as he's talking, right before he says something, I'm mouthing it. Okay? So he's like, well, my idea. And I'm like, like a family movie. I picked up a lot.
That's great. Very good experience. But does it, the ending of the book, or the ending of the cartoon part of the book, does that not depress you, Talia?
When the book was just pieces of paper in the beginning, it was at the publisher's for about 3 months, and I forgot what the story's about for a little bit, and I read it towards the end. I was like, "Oh, Dad, it's sad."
She doesn't like sad stories.
No. If I just see like a horse like on the floor, I'm like, "Oh." So, it's not that sad. I just get over dramatic about sadness, but it's not really that. I mean, it's sad, but anyway, the thing is that it actually has a sad part, but there's a little at the ending, there's a little twist to happiness. Like she finds a little section where there's a couple fish still left, and it has like in a couple years she might be able to save the ocean, so it has a little bit hope to it.
Right. And did it also spur you to take more action or want to take more action because of the fictional apocalyptic ending?
I know it did for a lot of my friends. I know it made them a lot of change. I before the book was written, I already wanted to do something just because my dad talked to me about it a lot. So I already wanted to do something, but I already was aware of the situation and the problems. I know for my friends who weren't so aware of it, it made them change their opinions a lot. I know that while my dad was doing a talk for my school, and he got to the part about fish farming, about 85% of people whispered to their friends, like, I'm gonna tell my mom to stop getting farmed fish, and I know that.
That's great. So it was having an impact. And one of the action items in the back of the book is to form a picket line outside a store or a restaurant.
Yes.
Have you done that?
No, it has a thing that at talks I usually read is the 7 useful traits of a movement or organizer, a movement organizer, and it's just things like It's you have to have respect, and you have to it's seven things that you need to have. That includes respect and. Give me a second. What is it? You think I know this?
You can read it out to us. That would be lovely.
Oh, okay.
Actually, while she's finding it, Mark, would you like to tell us one of your favorite fish tales? A nice short one.
One of my favorite fish tales.
Yes.
We did the hand lining, the tag and cod one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you something that really nice that happened to me. The other day in Boston, I was giving a talk in Boston, and this guy came up to me, and the last time I saw him, he was about 2 years old. He was the son of the first guy that I ever went fishing with, who was a tremendous fisherman and a really outstanding man who influenced me a lot. And this guy was like this little boy that I'd find little shells and things at sea and bring them back to him. And his father was gone now, but it was really nice to have that contact and to remember how, these people, I mean, we used to fish in this 45-foot wooden-hulled boat and have a great time of risking our lives together with no equipment but the little kazoo-like horn. We didn't have any radio or radar or anything. You'd be out there in open ocean and suddenly the sky and the fog, you know, would get kind of black and you'd see this, the realize it was the hull of a freighter that was about to run you over, you know, and the thing is going, mong, mong. You know, take out this little thing and go, doot, 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 doot. You know, and then you kind of hit the throttle and try to get clear of the thing. I don't know why I thought that was so much fun, but.
Sounds very much a male bonding experience, eh?
Yes.
So, Talia, do you have some,
yes,
some tips for us?
Seven useful traits of a movement organizer. 1, be studious. Know everything about your subject. Read books, articles, and websites. Be up on the latest developments. 2, be funny. Have a sense of fun and a sense of humor. Make your events fun. Let people laugh. You want people to join your movement, and no one wants to be in a movement where everyone is right but miserable. 3, be creative. It takes a great deal of imagination to think of actions that will surprise and get attention. 4, be empathetic. Care about other people's points of view and their feelings, and don't be embarrassed to show it. 5, be idealistic. Cynicism may at times seem fashionable, but does not produce results. While it may seem naive to think you can change things, every measure of progress in the history of humankind has been made up by people who are idealistic enough to believe they could do something. 6, be respectful. A successful movement is built by people with differing points of view. Treat everyone with kindness and respect, even your opponents. It will disarm those who disagree with your opinion and inspire those who already agree with you. 7, be patient. Change is a slow process with many setbacks. If your goals are clear and your determination unshakable, you can win in time.
Thank you, Talia Kurlansky, who's with her dad, Mark Kurlansky. This is for our radio listeners, talking about World Without Fish. Wonderful. So we have a question from the audience again. Could you talk about the garbage patch in the Pacific Ocean? The writer says, I feel this is something that more people are not concerned about. Is there a way to clean it up?
Not as far as anybody knows. You know, plastic doesn't break down completely, but it breaks down into little pieces, and sometimes they're even too small to see, but it's still just plastic. And they drift around in the ocean, and they end up in places where currents meet. So there was this spot in the center of the ocean called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is plastic. And there's a lot of fish in there. They feed on the plastic. And we don't, again, know what the impact of this has on
marine, we know it isn't good.
Marine life. It's not good. It's about 60 miles deep, and we're not sure how wide it is because, you know, you can't see it all, so it's hard to measure it. Some say it's bigger than the United States. Some say it's bigger than the state of Texas. If it were only the size of Rhode Island, it would be bad. Because it's so deep, there's no way to scoop it all up. And even if you did have a way, you would kill so much marine life in scooping it up because there's all kinds of fish in there feeding on it. So nobody's really come up with a way of cleaning it up. And of course it gets bigger every time you drink from a plastic bottle. Not necessarily. It depends what you do with the bottle. But I don't really understand why beverage companies can't go back to glass. I think that would be a really good idea. Not that that's the only source of plastic, but it is one of the major ones.
Especially if it has a deposit on it.
Yeah, I mean, we just use so much plastic. You know, all those bags that they could be paper bags. And, I live in New York City where nobody cooks. And, they get their meals brought to them every night in plastic. And it's just unbelievable how much plastic the average New York family goes through in a week.
Agreed. Question from the audience. Should Americans eat less fish?
why Americans? I don't know. But no, that's not the problem. The problem isn't that we're eating too much fish. The problem is we're having trouble figuring out how to manage the fishery. If everybody who was, I get this question all the time, you know, if everybody who's concerned about these problems were to stop eating fish, then the only people who would be eating fish would be the people who aren't concerned with these problems, and that would be disastrous. So instead of not eating fish, be very discriminating about what fish you eat. Consumers could actually regulate fisheries better than government if they chose well, but there's a lack of information. So what I always tell everyone to do is wherever you buy fish, and this is why the word Krulansky is going to become a curse word in the fishing business, because I say this all the time, ask them lots of questions about the fish before you buy it. And they won't have the answers. But if everybody did that, if they encountered this a lot, it would become part of the understanding of the fish business that consumers wanted to have this information. And of course, once you have the information, nobody's going to want to buy the fish with the bad story. Everybody's going to want to buy the fish that comes from the, you know, good sustainable fisheries. And so that's going to be where the money's at. And, you know, job done. There'll be this intermediate stage, which produce is at now, where they understand that it's what people want, but they figure they can just lie about it a lot. You know, so now, have you noticed that absolutely everything is organic? Fish will get to that point, too, where all fish will be sustainable. But, see, I think it's an encouraging sign when they're lying a lot. It means that they've gotten the message that that's what you want. And then the next phase will be to get them to start telling the truth.
But is there a labeling procedure in place? Is it beginning?
Yes, it is.
Is something we need to look for?
It is beginning. And, there's... there's some laws enacted on supermarket labeling, and stores like Whole Foods attempt to label everything, but their labeling is generally pretty inadequate, and it's not the information you need. There are some stores in New England, there probably are in California too, but I don't know this, where they really have come to understand this, and it's a feature of the store that they have lots of information on all the fish they sell, and people go there because they like that. It wouldn't be that hard to do. If you think about oysters, you know, when you buy oysters, you know everything about where that oyster came from.
Including the depth.
And the depth of the water and what place it came from. And the reason for that is gastronomic, because, you know, oysters are very different depending. They're like wine grapes, you know, where you grow them determines the flavor. But my point is that, you know, the information is made available, and that kind of information could be made available for all fish, too.
Have you come across Fishwise?
Fish?
Fishwise. It's a Santa Cruz-based organization.
Yes.
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 And they're really advocating for this.
Right.
Is that an organization you approve of?
Yeah, I mean,
has it got the Karlansky stamp of
approval? See, I don't want to be that person, but yeah, I mean, all these people who are trying to do this stuff, you know, I would encourage them.
Good. And which fish do you eat, Mark? What's your favorite fish? And tell us about it.
My favorite fish. I don't know. I have several favorite fish. I love halibut, which is endangered. But, you know, if you can find a good hand-lined halibut, and or it doesn't even have to be hand-lined, but single-lined. Talia loves fresh grilled sardines, which I also like a lot. And sardines are they're an excellent fish to eat, especially if you live in California, because the California sardine fishery is actually pretty good. And it's also healthy. It's low in the food chain. We should eat a little lower in the food chain, because all these bad things like heavy metals intensify as you go up the food chain, which is disturbing to think about if you think about who's at the top of the food chain. But and it's, you know, the kind of midwater pelagic fish that have all those oils and things that you want. Alaskan fisheries are very well managed, and, you know, Alaskan salmon is great. California and Oregon and Washington have wrecked their salmon populations, but Alaska has theirs well maintained, and that's great fish.
And what people talk about this expression, sustainable fishing, it's branded around a lot. What does it actually mean? Can you give us a kid?
I realize that people don't understand the term, because all the time I get this question. People say, but if we all ate sustainable fish, then wouldn't we run out of sustainable fish? And the answer is no, because what sustainable means is that the amount that you take is small enough so that it doesn't affect the population that's left, so you can do this forever and never run out of fish. Am I allowed to take her question, or does she have to write a card?
Because I'm really confused by that theory, and I hear a lot, but in theory, if we did manage all of our fisheries sustainably, and not just that they were managed sustainably in regulation, but they were enforced, then the amount of supply would decrease. And when your supply decreases, your demand is going to have to decrease. So my question is really, is there enough fish that if it's all sustainably fished, and there is no illegal fishing, and there's not fish coming from developing countries where it's less regulated and less enforced, would there be enough fish for us to all continue our consumption at this level and consume fisheries that are sustainable?
Okay, there's several things here. First, the short answer would be yes. But most of the fishing within the U.S. 200-mile limit is legal fishing, which doesn't necessarily mean that it's all sustainable. But legal and sustainable aren't the same concepts. But sustainable, you're not going to run out of sustainable fish, because that's what it means. Sustainable means that you don't run out, that you're sustaining the population. You can, the whole point of a sustainable fishery is that you can take that amount of fish in that technique forever and never, not only never run out of fish, but never diminish the size of the population. That's the definition of sustainable.
But I think how the market would adjust is the market would adjust and the price of fish is going up. Yeah, I think that's how it would.
Right now we're eating fish unsustainably. So if we're eating fish that's being caught unsustainably, wouldn't we have to consume less?
I'm sorry, if we're eating fish...
A lot of the fish that we're eating is, like the average American, is unsustainable fish, whether it's farmed or it's coming from developing countries, or it isn't being, or it's being over-harvested, etc. We haven't really achieved, we're on the track to achieve sustainable fishing in the U.S., but we haven't been up until this point.
Yeah.
And a lot of fish is actually coming from abroad, which is not sustainably fished. So if what we're consuming right now is not sustainably being fished, and this is the same, I mean, it's not really just America and Europe, developed countries, that if we started to manage all of our fisheries in the world sustainably, wouldn't our demand have to shift? We can't keep consuming at the level we are.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I'm sorry, I
didn't understand what you're saying. I don't think anybody actually has the answer to that, but possibly not, because... it's possible, it's the central problem. I mean, there's other problems, especially if you're talking about, you know, fishing in impoverished countries and stuff. There's a legal and foreign policy problem and stuff. But, you know, if you just look at, well-enforced 200-mile limits, Europe and North America, the problem there is arriving at the right formula. It's not an enforcement problem. They're being enforced. Fishermen are doing what they're told to do. And when you run into overfishing, what's meant by overfishing is that the government management said, okay, winter flounder stocks are in great shape, so they give... you know, these big numbers that you can take on winter flounder, everybody goes out and takes it, and they start noticing bad things happening to the stock. They're, whoops, we made a mistake there, and that's called overfishing. It's not that the fishermen, you know, went and did something they weren't supposed to do. They did what they were told to do, and it was wrong. And that is the, you know, the principal problem within regulated fisheries. But theoretically, we could get to a point where we had this down better, and we had all fisheries managed in a sustainable way, and it would certainly produce, you know, the amount of fish that we're taking now. Whether it could go up from there, I don't know. I tend to doubt. But we could probably fish sustainably the amount of fish that we're say the United States, that within the 200-mile limit of the United States, we could fish the amount we're taking now in a sustainable way if we could just figure it out better. But yes, fish has to become more expensive. And the reason fish has to become more expensive is there's two things. There's the reality of the market that, you know, if you're not flooding the market with lots of fish from factory trawlers, the natural economics dictates that it'll become more expensive. But also, if fishermen are going to earn a living bringing in less fish, the price for that fish has to go up. Now, there's a real built-in problem there, because, you know, I go around saying that fish has to be more expensive. And in fact, you know, anytime you run into cheap fish, fast food, anything like that, you will find abuse. You know, if it's cheap fish is the problem. So it has to be more expensive. I talk about fish. There's other people who talk about produce, and they're saying the same thing. You know, I was on this panel in L.A. a couple of days ago, and this economist was talking about how, you know, it would be good for the price of fuel to go up to $10 a gallon as a way of lowering fuel consumption. You know, so we all have these great formulas to make everything work by making everything more expensive. And I would like to know what poor people are supposed to be doing.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And I don't have that answer.
So, Mark, I'm afraid we have to wrap it up. We have time for just one last question. And I would like to ask, I'd like to leave the audience with some action items. One of your final chapters says we have to wake up and smell the fish. Can you leave us with perhaps if each of you could say one action item for people to go home with and share with their family and friends tonight, what would that one action item be?
Well, I think the most important thing that people can do is to get better informed so that they can be better consumers. I think that's the most important and accessible thing that everybody could do.
And you, Talia?
Well, I get asked the question a lot, what idea do you have for someone my age to have? And I always say, ask a lot of questions. Not, as my dad told me, not always you're going to get the answer, but if you ask a lot of questions, eventually you will get the answer. And that involves asking questions at supermarkets, to senators, or even the president. I've written letters to the president, and you will get a reply. They do hear what you write. And ask questions.
That's a great answer from Talia Kurlansky. I hope you all enjoyed tonight's program brought to you by Montalvo Arts and Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Mark Kurlansky and his beautiful daughter, Talia Kurlansky.
Thanks.
And thank you for sharing with us A World Without Fish.
Thank you.
Thank you.